Hello there, everyone. We are this is actually a special edition of the weekly. This is different to the normal one that we do where we round up the week. I am actually going to be winding down over the next week or two. But I don't worry, I will be coming back again, coming into September. But I thought that it would be quite a good time to have a look at what we think may happen in the final quarter of this year. Now, I normally, over the years, I have been talking, when I talk about quarters, I talk about Q1. So I will abbreviate them often to say Q1, Q2, Q3, etc. And I noticed that when I was talking to Ralph, that actually Ralph says 1Q, 2Q, 3Q, 4Q, right? So I thought, and I thought that actually this might be interesting for you. So we're going to start off quickly by talking about that, as to why I say Q2, why he says 2Q, and then we're going to
promise. I can also promise this podcast is going to get better.
Exactly, but anyway, we are then going to be talking about much more serious things, about politics, where we think that things are going to go for the rest of the year, economics, energy policy, and retail prospects for retail. So, anyway, and also it's so hot in here. I have got the window open, got the fan on, and I've got this as well because it's got to cool me down. So there we go. So, Ralphie, first of all, how are you?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm good. I haven't got a beer, but I'm good.
Excellent.
Did I mention that I had a knee operation?
You may well have done. You're getting better though.
Fine. Good. Let's not talk about this anymore. Okay, that was just last. Quarters. You wish to talk about quarters.
So I talk about Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4. Why do you do 1Q, 2Q, 3Q, 4Q?
Well, I think it's an analyst's thing. When I was a professional analyst, what you needed to do is you needed to sort of communicate growth rates a lot to people, both written and also, of course, also in your verbal communication with people when you're talking on the phone, etc. And it's not just the quarter within the year. You know, now we're obviously in 2022, so it's clearly obvious that Q1 will relate to 2022. Mm-hmm. But if you're an analyst, then you often have to compare this year to last year or even to the previous year. And then it gets very muddled if you say things like, well, Q1 20 versus Q1 19, because it's starting to sound like a number. 119 is like 119. And then, of course, if you say something like growth, Q1 20 over Q1 19 was 20%. I mean, you're just drowning in a morass of digits and nothing means anything anymore. So that's the reason that I say growth 1Q 20 over 1Q 19 was 10%. It's slightly more structured. It's slightly better in my view. And that's sort of, I think, how most of the city talked about it. I mean, I read my competitors' notes to understand why they were wrong, and I was right.
Of course you did. Yeah.
That is also how they referred to the quarters, and it was certainly the house style in all of the houses that I worked in. And so, that's basically that mystery solved.
Very, very good. Right. So, for the going into the end of the year, let's talk about the P word, politics. And we'll just have a quick scoot around the world, if indeed one can, on this front. So what do you think will be happening with Russia and Putin going into the end of the year?
I unfortunately, we can't ignore it. We have to talk about it. It's still dominating pretty much everything. Excuse me. And
you need to drink some of this.
Yeah, I do. Can I have a sip?
Yeah, hold on. There you go. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm not going to go near there.
Yes.
So, it's a transient situation. It's in flux. It develops. Yeah. It's very difficult for people like us who rely on journal journalistic information to actually make a forecast. But what I said previously is sort of what I still think. I think in one of the previous podcasts, I was sort of leaning myself out of the window a little bit much. And I was saying that this year we're going to get to some form of treaty or peace offering by Putin. This may be a little bit too optimistic, but I think the dynamics behind that statement are still are still in play. And what I observe is that Russia is finding it difficult to withstand the current ferocity of the onslaught. It might be difficult to make that statement if you just look at the news. But if you look at the news in detail and you see where these various campaigns are now being fought, then Ukraine has deliberately opened up another front in the south around Kherson. And Russia had to redeploy some of its forces from the east to that front. And they wouldn't have needed to do that if they did not, let's say, run at capacity. I'm not saying they're going to run out of steam. I don't know how much wishful thinking that is. But certainly it looks to me as if the Russian forces in the Russian campaign in the Ukraine, well, let's say, cannot be stepped up anymore from the current energy which we're seeing there. And the consequence of that is, I think, that Putin will need to do everything in his power to break the supply chain, which is currently going into the Ukraine and is increasingly working a lot better. I'm actually thinking this is turning out to be a war of supply chains. Russia is still remarkably, well, I don't know whether I should say the word incompetent. I can't judge this, but it looks incompetent in keeping up and building up its supply chains, even now. And of course, the Ukraine is relying on an intact and uninterrupted supply chain from the West. So I think Putin is, of course, going to see that too. And in order to dilute Western unity in supporting, keeping up this supply chain, keeping up the flow of weapons into the Ukraine, he may well announce a complete ban of Russian oil and gas into Europe. Now, he's sort of done this already. He's cut the pipeline into Germany for, air quotes, maintenance issues. And even if he doesn't announce something like this as an explicit policy, I would not be surprised in the slightest if he were to announce that maintenance is going to take a very long time indeed. Obviously, if that were to happen, I think what he would be trying to do is to, as I say, dilute the unity of the Western, of the European, but also the US, especially the European countries, and therefore win over the Ukraine by hoping that the Ukrainian supply chain is going to crumble. And in terms of 4Q, here we are. In terms of 4Q 22, you see, that's the reason why. Anyway, in terms of the fourth quarter, I would believe that if such a move were to happen, or if the maintenance of the pipeline continues, then we are going to feel the first impact of such a policy in the fourth quarter, both in terms of economics, but also in terms of pressure on political unity, which is already crumbling, I think.
No, interesting. I mean, obviously, it's we're in a fluid situation. I mean, I can't really add much to what you say there. I mean, I think that's absolutely correct. But I don't know. Obviously, we'll see how that turns out. Okay, so let's move on to Europe. I mean, I think with Europe, there's a lot going on at the moment, and we are seeing the supplies, obviously the energy supplies to Europe, severely restricted at the moment. And I think that obviously this is causing a lot of problems. It actually cut off, so Russia cut off supplies to essentially to Central Europe, so made it very difficult for them. And I think that if one of the aims of his invasion of Ukraine was to break Europe up, or at least cause it problems, it seems to be working quite well. Because he's, you know, obviously driving a wedge between so Central and Eastern Europe and Western Europe. He's driving, he's again driving a wedge between the supporters of, or those a bit more sympathetic towards Moscow and those that aren't. And Italy is a great example of that because, of course, Italy has traditionally been probably the most, the closest of the big Western nations to Russia in terms of sort of political support and things. So, you know, it's driving a wedge between everyone, and it seems to be working quite well with the idea that presumably if you've got a split opposition, essentially, it makes it easier for you to roll out your own agenda. So, so I think in terms of, you know, what do you think are the prospects for the fourth quarter?
Yes.
I almost said Q4, but anyway, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, this is sort of what I was leading towards. I mean, the way in which a complete ban of oil and gas from Russia to Europe would put pressure on political parties and politicians in Europe is precisely in the way you just outlined. Because, well, we've talked about it for a long time, and everybody knows this, of course. There's cost of living crisis, discretionary incomes are melting, people can't heat their homes, etc. The financial crisis is becoming existential for some households. Mm-hmm. And these households are, not all of them, but some households amongst them, are going to be easy prey mm-hmm. for the messages of populists. Mm-hmm. And that is what we're seeing already, notably in Italy, mm-hmm. with the split up of the Five Star Party, mm-hmm. Where basically populists are, and I would claim deliberately exploiting the current crisis mm-hmm. in order to find support in a population which is just generally disappointed by developments and is facing existential issues. Now, that is not only the case in Italy. We've seen this in France in the run-up to the presidential elections, where Le Pen very cleverly fought the political campaign not on issues of racism immigration, but on issues of household income. And we know that Le Pen had a very good run into the presidential elections. Now we see that although Macron has been able to maintain his presidency, he's lost the majority of his party in Congress. And, well, that's probably the wrong word, in the Assemblée Nationale, in Parliament. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you have pressure points there.
Yeah.
And Putin is, I'm sure, seeing all this. Moving to the UK, there the situation is obvious to all of us. We've just, the Conservative Party has just ousted Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. We're having the hustings currently to elect the next one. It is looking as if Liz Truss is appealing more to the grassroots of the Conservative Party than Rishi Sunak. And I would claim that the reason for that is, again, a dose of populism. Because Liz Truss is promising, well, not the citizens of the country, because this is not where the hustings are directed, but the grassroots of the Conservative Party, promising that the crisis is going to be short-term alleviated simply by tax reductions. And she's doing this in an almost ideological way. When you listen to her, she often says in the debates, she often says things like raising taxes or keeping taxes at an elevated level is unconservative. Well, that's not a good argument. I mean, whether something is unconservative or not conservative is not the issue. This shouldn't be the issue. What should be the issue is whether whether an economic crisis can be alleviated by certain policy or not. And so I can see that there's a certain amount of populism which is being pandered in most European, in many European countries at the moment. And that is, I think, the wedge you were speaking of. That's the leverage which Putin must see he would potentially have. And again, so now I'm coming back to what I said earlier, that is the reason why I'm expecting him to cut off oil and gas, just in order to increase the pressure points and hoping to drive a wedge into what is currently still a remarkable united front and dilute the united front and obtain an advantage in his invasion of the Ukraine. Right.
Absolutely. So, yes, I mean, I think this, we are in a very tricky situation at the moment. So yes, I think that the we'll talk about the prospects, sort of economic prospects, in a minute for Europe. So what about Asia then? I mean, I think Asia's quite interesting. Obviously, we've got China is causing a lot of unease in the region. So, you know, you've got Japan, which after the assassination of its previous prime minister, the upper house, they voted, put forward, well, the vote has essentially made it easier for Japan to be more militarily not aggressive, but it will free them up to get involved more. Traditionally, since the war, they've had this constitution. It's been known as a pacifist constitution, and they're very much in the whole kind of we're in defense mode. But with recent movements in not only from actually China but also North Korea as well, you know, doing firing missiles and things, doing testing, there is a lot more unease. I think that Japan's got it's the most chance it probably has had since the war to actually change its constitution. But all of this, central to all of this, is the whole rising concerns in the Asia Pacific region about China potentially invading Taiwan. That was made more into a trickier situation by the recent visits of Pelosi, which annoyed China greatly. I mean, my own sort of pet theory with that is that I wonder where, you know, I thought that the Pelosi visit was made at a particularly sensitive time, because I feel that on a macro front, China is in a not precarious position, but a more precarious position than it has been in the past, where you've had rising debt, you've got a real estate sector which is in all sorts of problems, particularly China Evergrande, $300 billion in debt. The real estate sector in China is extremely important. It really touches everyone. So there's all this kind of bad feeling. There's the feeling that constantly getting locked down, you know, so they're just about picking up. Then a variant comes along, everything's shut down. The GDP, end of year GDP, a growth forecast looks of 5.5% looks very dodgy at the moment. So my argument has been that potentially the Pelosi visit came at a very sensitive time, because I think that, you know, in some cases in the past, that countries are most dangerous when things are going wrong internally on the domestic front, because then they are more inclined to maybe have a war or do something like that in order to galvanize some kind of nationalist spirit and potentially take the focus off the problems domestically and turn it into a, you know, us versus the world. Now, I know you actually said something very interesting on that point, I thought, Ralph, when we talked earlier.
Did I really?
You did. about, yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, the only thing there, I mean, first of all, I think that is true, but I wonder to which extent that is more true for democratic countries than it is for autocratic ones. Mm. Because if we need a war to unite domestic dissent, let's say, well, then obviously there has to be domestic dissent in the first place. China is an autocratic communist country. There is no dissent. I mean, there may be, of course, there is dissent. There's a lot of dissent, as we've seen in the violent protests in Hong Kong, which just wouldn't die down. But there is no organized political dissent. And there is no institutionalized dissent. And so China also, again, as evidenced by its clampdown, again, violent clampdown on the protests in Hong Kong, doesn't really need to wage a war outside of its order, outside of its borders to focus public opinion on it. It just needs to quash violence through the application of violence. And so that is why I wonder whether that motivation might be as much in evidence in, well, in any autocratic country, but specifically China, because we're talking about it. But yes, I mean, you may be right. I mean, there may be a contributory factor. It certainly is the case that Xi Jinping is about to come into a new term. I don't know exactly when it is. It should be nowish, almost this month or certainly next. And clearly nothing is going to happen before then. But I do wonder what China might actually do, actually, to be honest with you, in the medium term, by which I speak still of 10 years. It is militarily not so easy to invade Taiwan, actually, because it is 100 kilometers off the coast, and everything there has to be naval and air based. And again, we're talking about supply. Yes, of course, the supply chain to the Chinese border is unencumbered and cannot be interrupted. But this, it is going to be more difficult than I think people may think to establish a lasting presence in Taiwan. Anyway, so in terms of 4Q,
I love this. Yeah, go on.
Now we're talking about longer term developments. They are difficult to anchor into a quarter. But in terms of 4Q, what I will say is this. I mean, 4Q is going to be after September, which means after we know who our new prime minister is. That's the theme from the UK. And it will be after Xi Jinping is going to be anointed into his next term. And so I'm guessing that the discussion about these dynamics is going to be a lot more, let's say, tangible, and is becoming a lot more, tangible is not a bad word, in terms of real rather than speculation, starting from the fourth quarter.
Cool.
Or perhaps starting from the first quarter, because fourth quarter is always the quarter with Christmas here in the European countries and in the free world, perhaps you can say. And so perhaps the focus is not going to be that much on it. But I think starting from these developments, starting from which coincide with the 4Q, I think we're going to hear a lot more of this. And the situation in Taiwan is going to be one which is going to be more obvious in focus in the media and in the attention of the military institutions and secret services.
Okay, fair enough. By the way, I just wondered there, when you say 4Q, if this was like, you know, when on YouTube they do automated captions at the bottom, if you said 4Q in a certain way, would an insult kind of pop up in terms of the automated captions, perhaps? I don't know. Anyway,
Are you talking about my German accent?
No, I'm
sir?
Not. I'm talking of...
Oh, yes, you do. I'm going to be offended
now.
Because this is another thing we need to talk about. Well, actually, we don't. It's a business podcast, isn't it? But people are offended all the time. It's great fun to be offended.
Funny,
and I'm offended now. In fact, I'm going to leave.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. You're going to drive me to drink.
I'm sorry.
So anyway, so the final one, of course, the big one, is the US. So, I mean, my impression is that it's not been going particularly well. I did think it was quite interesting. I saw that, you know, that there was an email from Rula Kala from the FT who clearly, you know, emailed me just personally, along with a few hundred thousand of her closest friends, sort of basically saying something along the lines of, you know, he's on the verge of something historic, signing, you know, a bill worth $700 billion, etc. But I would actually argue that I don't think he has done particularly. I'm coming at this as a neutral. I want him to do well, right? Because I really didn't like Donald Trump, and I want him to do well. However, it seems to me that he bodges things. You know, he, you know, this thing that he supposedly got together, the minimum corporation tax, minimum global corporation tax. I mean, you know, that seems to be falling apart at the moment. There's the there are various other things, and then of course there's the very high profile Roe v. Wade, which I think has been particularly bad. Then of course he sent Pelosi over I don't know what he achieved there at a very difficult time. You know, he just seems to bodge and make mistakes all the time. But, you know, what do you think are the prospects for, you know, politically in the US for the fourth quarter?
Yes, again, the fourth quarter is interesting because it is after another date, like in the UK, after September. This time it is after November, the 8th of November, I believe, is the date for the midterm elections. And we're going to see whether the Democrats are going to be able to maintain their, well, they don't even have a lead in the Senate, but it's just half and half. So whether they're going to maintain that position or whether they will have to accept a majority of Republicans. And given where the journey is going in America, would not be surprised in the slightest if we'd see a renaissance of Republican majority in the Senate. And that is, of course, going to be a problem because I think I agree with you. What I've seen so far from the Biden administration is, well, there's nothing really which they can point to as an achievement, to be perfectly honest. I mean, the foreign policy has been disastrous with the exit from Afghanistan in the way it was done. Arguably, the thing which they are doing well is supporting the Ukraine with a very material financial package and weapons indeed. So that's on the plus side. But also in terms of domestic policy, I can't see how the Biden administration is managing what increasingly looks to me to be a polarization of US society into a into a very conservative and liberal part. Let's put it this way. It's actually quite hard to define what conservative means in this case. It's a worldview which sees federal governments, federal policies as an illegitimate intrusion into your private life. You know, that's used to be what the Tea Party was stood for. That's what the sort of near-militant Christianity and evangelism which we see in the US stands for. This is, of course, what Trump galvanized. And it has already led to situations which 10 years ago we would have thought were unthinkable, like an actual physical, violent invasion of the Capitol. Of the most sacred government building, seat of government of the US. And so I do wonder whether there is going to be a flashpoint somewhere. Events keep coming. You mentioned Roe v. Wade. which arguably perhaps that is not in the power of the executive, that's not in the power of Biden to do anything about, but it highlights where the fault lines run in U.S. society. Now you just have to look on the map and see how many states have basically banned abortion and how many states have allowed it to happen. And so within that sort of volatile gas, if you like, of American society, I would have hoped for a leader who is able to unite the country more than Biden obviously has done. And economically, I don't think the so-called Rust Belt states, which helped him win this time round and helped Trump win the previous time, they have not felt any meaningful economic improvement. And so if you take all of this together, I would not be surprised if the Democrats lost their grip on Congress, making any further political implementation of policy, any further implementation of policy in the second half of their administrative term very difficult indeed.
Absolutely. I mean, it's difficult. It's been difficult enough already, hasn't it? But the possibility of it getting worse is I think has increased. But anyway, right, so that's politics. Let's move on to economics. What do you think? We're going to be talking about recession, interest rates, inflation. So what do you reckon then? I mean, where do you think we're going to go into a global recession?
Perhaps. I mean, let's look closer to home, perhaps in Europe. And I include the UK now in Europe territorially. So it might be a story of it's getting better before it gets worse, unfortunately. And the reason for that is that after the COVID situation has abated to the level in which we're now in, economies have reopened. And that reopening has produced, you know, a solid improvement in GDP growth. It's not massive, it's single digits, but it is visible. And that happened in European countries even to a larger extent. Or it's a different phase. I think in Europe it happened, if you look at 2Q over 1Q, see this works? You're not confused, are you? 2Q 22 over 1Q 22, that's sequential growth. Moving on. Anyway, that's where that happened. And in the UK, it happened in previous sequential comparisons. So I think the UK is already running out of steam. Europe is still having the benefit of some momentum there. But if you look at all the dynamics which we have been discussing, which have been highlighted by the press, which have been in focus in everybody's mind for the last several months: high inflation, high energy costs, discretionary income squeeze, high interest rates, mortgage goes up. I mean, nothing is good in summary. Therefore, I think consumer confidence is going to absolutely take a knock, and people are going to have to keep their money together just in order to be able to heat their homes. None of these things are conducive to economic growth. And so to me, it is certain that the European countries are going to slide into recession. When that is going to happen is another question. It may not actually happen in the fourth quarter, in 4Q 22. It might happen in 1Q 23, but I'm pretty sure it will happen in 1Q 23.
Interesting.
Oh, but by the way, just one word on this. There is a niggly kind of technical issue. I mean, a recession really only is technically present if you have two consecutive quarters of contraction. Yes. And so, negative growth is what we would normally say. And so technically, we would have to wait for the second quarter, 23, in order to be able to say, okay, 2Q23 on 1Q23 was a contraction, 1Q23 on 4Q22 was a contraction. That's now right, we're in recession. Yeah. So that's kind of how this would need
absolutely.
To work.
I mean, for what it's worth, I mean, very, very briefly, I think firstly, US is in recession. It's in denial also at the moment because it's making the rules up as it goes along. I think I personally believe that Europe will go into recession in quickly, more quickly than the UK. And the reason why I say that is because, well, there's a few reasons. Well, the main reason is the energy problem. And I think that, you know, there's a lot more manufacturing in Europe than there is in the UK. And therefore, they are much more exposed. And therefore, I think that they will go down faster. So that's my opinion on that. And the other thing as well, I feel that a lot of the governments are pretty in weak positions at the moment because they don't have majorities, or they're having, you know, like Italy's having an election. And I mean, you've got a three-way coalition in Germany, all these kinds of things, I think is going to make it harder for them to make the hard decisions, and therefore they're more likely to fall in harder, in my opinion. In terms of the UK, I think that my base case, as it were, is I feel that we might hang on to the current quarter, be okay, but maybe the final quarter in the UK may be difficult. And therefore, we would need to further see a contraction in the first quarter, as you say, in order to have two consecutive quarters of contraction. I think that there's a couple of things that may help, possibly, I think, in the UK specifically. So one is having a new leadership. I mean, we don't know what the final policies are actually going to be, but you would have thought that whoever it is going to want to try to pep up the country and try to be more popular, and therefore may be more inclined to do things that do stimulate the economy. So I think there's an outside chance that actually things may get better, or, you know, may conceivably get better because they're a new administration, and therefore they have an excuse to say ditch things that maybe haven't worked and try something else. So possibly, I don't know. So I would say that that's one thing. And then the other thing, of course, is that we are not as reliant on Russia for our energy as Europe. So I still think, though, that we will fall into recession, but I think it's more likely next year than it is this year. So there we go.
Yeah, I believe that's right. It's more likely next year than this year. Especially also, do you think that maybe we're going to get a decent shot in the arm from a reasonably strong Christmas?
I wonder whether we are going to. Someone was asking me this the other day, and I think that I seem to remember that last Christmas, everyone was getting excited about it, you know, lots of spending going on. And then we saw lots of, in the leisure sector, you saw restaurants and pubs and things. They're all seeing bookings rising. And I remember actually, you know, I've got Watson's Daily Ambassadors, working with me, and we were going to do a Christmas party and everything, but it had to, you know, it had to get cancelled. Everyone had to cancel because Omicron came along. And so I think that although that was almost a good, it was a good Christmas, but I think for a lot of people, it looked like it was going to be a great Christmas, and then it sort of got downgraded. So I think there is an outside chance that people are going to throw caution to the wind potentially this Christmas. They're going to, you know, they're going to go out, they're going to spend, and yes, they're going to go more into debt. They're going to use credit more. And then we are going to see the big dose of reality going into next year. I mean, I think that at the moment everyone is feeling. I mean, I know I'm feeling the bills on the, you know, on the food front, and certainly on the utilities bills front as well. So I mean, I'm already feeling it at the moment. But I think that yes, there is a chance that may happen, and that we may be okay. Potentially, you know, we might get a little bit of a boost at the end of the year, but then, like I say, the beginning of next year will be tough.
Yeah, I think these are going to be the dynamics. I kind of expect a reasonable Christmas, to be honest, which is almost going to ensure that we're going to see a technical recession in the first quarter, because it's going to be compared to a tough comparable. So fourth quarter is going to go up a little bit, and then first quarter is going to go down more than that because of energy bills coming in. And the other quick thought I wanted to share with you guys is the next question is then also, of course, how long is that recession going to last and how severe is it going to be? And of course, I have no idea, but just one benchmark for this. The last recessionary dynamic we've seen, which is now called the Great European Recession, was in 2008, coinciding with the financial crisis. And that lasted for 2 years, which is very long indeed by sort of modern standards. And I think the reduction from maximum to minimum was something like 2 percentage points. So it may be that we're not going to have such a lasting recession as 2 years. I'm sort of currently penciling in maybe a year, which is actually quite a conservative expectation already. But so that's what we're going to see more highlighted in the press, in commentary as we go into next
Absolutely.
Year. So that's just what I'm going to say in terms of our commercial awareness. I don't know where it's going to be, but we can be sure that that's going to be a topic which is going to start as early as we go into next
now,
year.
I mean, I just wanted to introduce a thought to people. Now, this may be completely wrong, but I just thought it was interesting to bring up. You know, everyone is kind of assuming that we are going to be falling into recession and say, you know, that it's going to go badly into the end of the year. But I wonder what would happen if, you know, the leadership changed in this country. They brought in various measures and maybe by the skin of our teeth, we can make it to the end of the year without our GDP growth contracting. So if that happens, I would expect the politicians concerned to say, hey, look, everyone else has gone into recession. We haven't, you know, we're leading you through. Therefore, feel more confident, go out and spend. We're going to save you. Now, I mean, I know it's not going to be quite like that, but, you know, I think it'd be quite interesting to think about what would happen if we didn't contract. I mean, it looks like we are going to, but if we didn't, I don't think anyone's really expecting it. So, you know, I just thought I'd throw that in terms of just to try to give an opposing argument potentially for what might happen going into the end of the year. But anyway, but there you go. I know
Going into the end of the year, I think you may actually even be right, because the recession, I think we also agreed, may actually take hold next year. But, I'm unhappy to report that I'm pessimistic on your take, simply because the realities will be that energy bills are going to spiral. So a politician who just basically says, oh, look, we are not in recession, everybody else is. Yes, of course, they will say that because the politicians. But as long as the the government will not be able to support people and help them with their energy bills in a meaningful way and in a means-tested way, by the way. It's no good to give everybody 400 quid. If I had 10 properties that hand me 4,000 quid, you know, but then clearly I'd be rich and I wouldn't need this. So it needs to be mean-tested help. Unless a government is able to do that, I don't think the citizenry of a country will necessarily support such a government. But we will have to see. So I'm more pessimistic than I normally am.
Well, no fair,
next year.
Fair enough.
I have to say.
And which actually, I mean, I suppose it leads us into the last thing about in energy policy. And just to say, you know, what we think about that. I mean, I really think you're right. I think that the whole thing about it needs to be means tested. I was talking about this the other day. I know I was saying to someone, it's a bit like everyone getting a free bus pass when they reach retirement age, whether you're a billionaire or whether you're not. you know, it's always been a bit ridiculous, that. And I kind of think that the same thing applies or will apply here. And I feel that what needs to be done, I mean, I feel that it's a bit defeatist of the government to say, well, you know, it's logistically really difficult and we can't do it. We can't give it to certain sectors of society. But I think that that's a poor excuse. You know, I feel that, you know, what we need to do is to find a way of actually doing that. And I think there's more ways. Surely there are more ways now that all, you know, data and stuff is going more online. We can analyze these things much more efficiently than in the past. And I would have, in my naivety, thought that, you know, it should be easier. And if it isn't, it should be made easier. And it won't just be for things like this. It could be for all sorts of things, that some kind of framework whereby you have a more robust way of distributing taxes, or, you know, that sort of thing. It would be so much more efficient. So I kind of think, in my ideal, you know, my ideal world, is that maybe the government, you know, goes to the utilities companies and throws the money at them to make sure that our bills don't go to ridiculous levels for, say, let's say 3 to 6 months, which would take us kind of towards the end of winter. And then after that, you know, or during that period, they work out something, a way that they can do this distribution, start implementing it in, say, March, April next year. And then it means that if anything like this happens again, there can be more even distribution. But anyway, I mean, that's obviously my pie in the sky, you know, hopeful vision, etc. But anyway, I mean, what do you think about energy policies? What should be?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it should be possible. I mean, first of all, the idea that it is somehow philosophically unjust to just target a group of people is completely ridiculous, because there are direct taxes in every country, in every tax system, and that's completely proper. Like roads tax, for example, I have to pay road tax because I am the owner of a vehicle which I use on public roads. Somebody doesn't have a vehicle and therefore doesn't use up the public goods, public roads, doesn't have to pay the tax, and that's fine. You see, this is a direct tax directed at a group of people, and so philosophically this is absolutely fine, and there shouldn't be an issue with this, because nobody has an issue with this. Claiming that somebody has an issue with this is disingenuous. So, and the second point then is, it should be bureaucratically or administratively possible to do this, because we do have a progressive tax system already, and therefore different groups of people are taxed in different orders of magnitude. So I think it really should be not an insurmountable problem to direct financial support to households who are in need of such support, and only to such households. And if it needs to be done by way of a tax reduction, then what otherwise would be a support could be perhaps a tenth of a percentage point reduction in somebody's income tax, which is not going to be an income tax reduction per se. It's just the equivalent of directing a support, an aid package to somebody who's in need of it. So it makes it means tested. I mean, that should all be possible to do, and it will be interesting to see to which extent the next prime minister in our country is going to do this. I mean, Rishi Sunak has just revealed a £10 billion scheme aiming to do something like that, whereas Liz Truss has been more silent on this, which in itself I don't understand and may not bode well for a government under under Liz Truss, but we will have to see. I mean, first of all, she's not prime minister yet, and then we'll just have to judge her. If she were to be prime minister, we just have to judge her by her actions. But I agree, that would be something which I would certainly very much support. And I think it should also be possible to do that through, for example, also more directed way of redistribution. I don't think a windfall tax on energy companies is such a big no-no, but I fear that the Conservative Party is becoming more ideological and doesn't really want to do this because it is seen to be, air quotes, unconservative, not because it is seen to have a potential negative income on the economy, if such an argument could be made.
Well, there we go. I mean, I think we'll leave it there. I mean, we've talked about, kind of how confidence and what can potentially happen towards the end of the year, covered energy, etc. So, I mean, obviously, we've covered quite a lot of ground, I think, in today's. And I just think it's good, you know, as food for thought. And I think that we will be revisiting these thoughts at regular intervals, you know, obviously over these podcasts. But yes, is there anything else you wanted to say, Ralph, at all?
No, the only thing is that I think Peter Watson is going on holiday
for
the first time in 10 years.
This is amazing. This is another reason for the sort of winding down over the next week or two. So next week I am going to be writing Watson's Daily as normal, but I'm not going to be doing all the posting of the all the social media stuff and the podcast. And then I'm going away for a week, which, I mean, I still almost can't quite believe, but that'll be great. And then we'll come back again, hit the ground running. And I'm looking forward to it.
You're going to do something really cool, aren't you? Like backpacking in Kathmandu or downhill biking in Whistler, aren't you?
No, you, Peter? Not quite.
Do you want to tell us what you're going to do?
Disneyland Paris. So, yeah. So, actually, I said that to someone to...
I got him to say it.
It's so funny because actually I was talking to someone today. I went to a shop today and we were having a conversation. I was having a conversation with the person at the counter and I said, oh, you know, I'm going away. It's my first holiday for 10 years. She said, oh, where are you going? I said, Disneyland Paris. She said, what a nice person. You know, you're thinking of the kids. You're not going to where you want to go. And I was thinking, yeah. But actually, I kind of do want to go, actually. so that's quite good. So,
okay.
I'm really looking forward to it. And it'd be nice just to, have a holiday, to be honest.
Look, it should actually be really cool. I was in Disney World in Florida for the wedding of my nephew-in-law, and it was really fun. There were water parks and everything. No,
I'm looking forward to it.
Fun.
But anyway, yes, we'll see. But anyway, thank you very much, as always. Always a brilliant pleasure to have you on this, Ralph. And
thank you, Peter, for inviting me.
We'll be back very soon. We've got a few little surprises up our sleeves for you as well. So keep watching because there's some pretty good cool stuff coming your way. And anyway, right, okay,
cool
thanks very
on.
Much indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Cool. All right.
Bye.
Cheers, guys. Cheers, Peter.